Welcome to the program. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5. Today we're joined with John Robbins, and we're delighted to have him on the program. So we don't have that much time, so I want to jump right into the interview. Maybe you can start off, John, by just reflecting a little bit on your personal journey to your current belief system and your political work, and just giving our listeners an introduction, a personal introduction to who you are and how you came to think about the world in the way that you do.
Okay, well, I was born into the heart of the great American food machine. My dad and my uncle founded what became the world's largest ice cream company, Baskin-Robbins, 31 flavors. And during my childhood, I was groomed by my dad to eventually take over that company, to succeed him and run the business. But I felt pulled in a different direction from within myself because I didn't want to sell a product that was undermining people's health. And my own family showed that. My uncle, Bert Baskin, my dad's partner and brother-in-law, one of the co-founders and co-owners of Baskin-Robbins, died of a heart attack at the age of 51. And he was a very big man, very overweight. And when he died, I asked my dad if he thought there might be any connection between the amount of ice cream my uncle ate and his fatal heart attack. And my dad said, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. His ticker just got tired and stopped working. And I could understand why my dad wouldn't want to consider the possibility even that there might be a connection, because he didn't want to think the family product was hurting anybody. But it was. And I'm not saying an ice cream cone is going to hurt anybody, but the more ice cream that you eat, the more likely you are statistically to have a heart attack or to have diabetes, which my father developed very seriously. And another interesting example of that is Ben Cohen, the Ben of Ben and Jerry's ice cream company, who at the age of 49, a couple of years ago, had a quintuple bypass procedure.
Oh, wow.
Also an overweight fellow, very socially conscious guy with a lot of, doing a lot of good peace work, but still eating a lot of ice cream and bearing the consequences. And so I moved away from that. I made a choice not to be, work in the ice cream business, not to take over my dad's company, and in fact not to be involved at all, and in fact not to have any access to my dad's wealth, because I wanted to live by very different values than those that the company represented. And I wanted to be really distant from, because if I was tied into the company, the ice cream company, in any way at all, certainly living off its revenues would be a tie, then I wouldn't be objective in my own voice. And as the years have gone by and I've come to write books about the food industry and the dairy industry and how these products are manufactured and what their health consequences are and how they treat the animals that are involved in these operations, it's been important for me to have that objectivity, have that distance that I wouldn't have had if I had accepted any of the money. So I felt glad that I made the choice that I did.
Mm-hmm. In one of the interviews that I read with you, someone compared you actually to Siddhartha and saying, you know, this was someone who's also born into privilege and has walked away from that in order to gain, a broader, deeper spiritual perspective on life and, quality of life issues and to do your political work. So I thought that was an interesting comparison.
Well, I actually appreciate that because when I was 18, I read the book Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, and it profoundly affected me. I stayed up all night the night after I finished it, just walking the streets under the moonlight. I was so impacted by that book. And it was a couple of years later that I made the decision and told my dad I wasn't going to do it. And then I spent the next 10 years after that living on a little island off the coast of British Columbia in a one-room log cabin that my wife and I had built. And we were meditating and doing yoga for many hours a day. So the story of Siddhartha, the way Hermann Hesse told it anyway, did represent a model for my life in many respects.
Mm-hmm. It seems, a theme that I get from your work is that there's a really important connection between spiritual enlightenment, journeying, and political work. And I wanted to address both of those issues or sort of intermingling of issues in the interview, but maybe we could start off to talk about more concretely the kind of world you hope to help build, the vision that you have for what a more sustainable future would look like. What are some of the issues that you address in your work?
Well, you know, you mentioned the connection between the outer work, the political work, the activist work, and the inner work, the work towards becoming a more enlightened and human being, completely human being, fully, you know, embracing our humanity. To me, they're the in-breath and the out-breath. They're the left foot and the right foot. They're the two sides of the same process by which we become fully effective in our lives and really live as opposed to just surviving. And in order to live, in order to undertake the great work of our lives, I think we need to have a vision of who we are becoming together as human beings in these times, what is possible for us, as distinct from what is probable. We can find what's probable everywhere. You know, there's always people predicting and speculating and betting and investing on what's going to happen, and even making investments on the downside, you know, profiting from wars, war toys or war implements and the military-industrial complex. But I think if we are going to be a counterforce to that, we need to have a vision in ourselves and invest ourselves, our resources, our genius, our time and energy, our love, into that vision of what is possible. And to me, that's a world that works for everybody. To me, that's a world that is just, that is not oppressing people, where our prosperity isn't dependent on someone else's exploitation, where our prosperity instead is a product of our cooperative, reciprocal mutuality with life, where we honor the interdependence that we have with all other beings, with all forms of life. That includes people who are different color skin than we have, people who come from different ethnic backgrounds, different cultures and religions, different social classes, different countries. And it also includes the different forms of life, different kinds of animals and plants. And so that instead of looking upon the natural world as a set of resources to convert into revenue, we look upon the natural world as an act of beauty in which we participate, which gives us our being. And then we are working alongside of life rather than trying to dominate it. And it's a whole different way of life. This is my vision, you see, of a way of life that is thriving for all, a way of life that works for everyone, rather than one that works only for an elite few who dominate the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. John, to sort of bring that spirituality into our diet, I really like Woody Harrelson's quote in the front of Food Revolution, where he says, "A person who leads me to eat in a way that cultivates spiritual awareness is my kind of prophet." And I wanted to know, how is that? How can the way we eat actually cultivate spiritual awareness?
Well, Woody's a great guy, and he's a friend of mine, and he was very sweet to write that. The way we eat is going to impact our psyches. It's obviously going to affect our health. People are realizing that more and more these days. But it's also going to affect the way we think, the way we experience ourselves, the way we process our emotions, our moods, and our relationship to ourselves. And if we're eating in a way that's in alignment, that's consistent with our values, that's feeding and nurturing ourselves with the nutrients they need, but we're not deluging ourselves with artificial preservatives and chemicals and the products of factory farms, which convey the suffering of the animals there. So we're eating a lighter, cleaner diet that's earth-friendly, that's organic when possible, that's eating lower on the food chain so that others may eat as well, so we're not expropriating an undue amount of resources onto ourselves and therefore costing others' lives. When we do that, when we bring our food choices into alignment with who we really are and what we want and love and cherish and care about, then what happens is, my experience has been, that something is lit within us. We become capable of taking more responsibility for ourselves. We become capable of doing more on behalf of life itself. We cease to be passive, resigned, and broken people just trying to get by coping with the next thing that comes and hits us in the face. And we start to, much more than that, come from a vision. We're coming from what's possible rather than what reacting to what's right in front of us. And it's a different kind of life. It's a life lived with a vision, lived within a vision. We then start telling others of our vision. Our lives become statements of what we love and care about. And we really do become, something sacred takes place in that. Something, we come back to life.
It seems somewhat ironic. On the one hand, I think that, the vision that you put forward, you said, so, you know, you don't just have this very small group of people, you know, generating this huge amount of wealth by exploiting others, animals, the earth. So it's a vision that sort of counteracts that sort of elitism. But at the same time, I feel on Animal Voices, when we talk about issues around veganism or organic food or trying to eat bioregional, that sometimes something that's charged against people that are putting forward that vision is to say that's very elitist unto itself, that, you know, a lot of people can't afford organic food, or it's just sort of too much to think about. I don't have the time to research all of these different companies. I just need to go to the grocery store and get some food and feed my kids. And how do you respond to people who feel like this type of diet, this type of lifestyle is elitist and not really practical for the average citizen?
Well, a lot of us live in communities where it's a lot easier to find a Snickers bar or a Big Mac or a Coca-Cola than it is an apple. A lot of us live in neighborhoods where there's convenience stores that sell foods that are totally junk, and it's really hard to get healthy food. That's something I'm trying to change. That's something I'm trying very hard to change. In the meantime, we do the best that we can, each of us, in the situation we're in. And I look forward to the day that that our departments of agriculture cease to subsidize chemical-based agriculture, agribusiness, and start to instead subsidize organic foods so that the price does come down, and so that they do become more widely available, because it shouldn't be the prerogative only of the wealthy few to eat healthy food.
Mm-hmm.
That should be a basic human right. I'm working very hard for the day that that is recognized, not only in my own heart and thoughts, but in our society's social structures and political and economic structures.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very important thing. Currently, we live in a toxic food environment. Most of the food that we eat is pretty bad, unfortunately. But it could be remedied fairly simply. Just let me give you one simple example. We could tax junk food and use the revenue stream from the tax to subsidize and lower the price and widen the availability of healthy food. For example, we could put a tax on white bread that's made from white flour, and use that money to lower the price of whole wheat bread. So that would, in effect, raise the price of white bread because it would be taxed, but it would lower the price of whole wheat bread. So what would happen then, it would be people would be eating more whole wheat bread, and that would, by the law of supply and demand, there would be more of it produced. And in time, everyone would be healthier as a result of that. Right now, the sugar industry, the processed and junk food industries as a whole, and the high animal fat industries have such a control over food policies in the Western world and in the industrialized world, and increasingly throughout the globe, that people's health is suffering tragically from that. And if someone, you know, there's one other piece I want to mention, because you were saying that someone might say, well, I just need to get to the supermarket and get what's there and feed my family. I can't research all these things. Well, that's one of the reasons I write the books I do, is to do that research for people and make it easier for them to know what to do to eat healthily and eat an earth-friendly diet.
Mm.
But I think that it can be very difficult, and I do understand that. But when we oppress ourselves by thinking that we can't do anything better than just conform to the social norm, the prevailing social paradigm, do what McDonald's expects us to do, eat the junk food, you know, eat at Burger King and eat what Monsanto finds profitable to produce. And when we do that, we're internalizing the oppression, and we become the vehicle of our own oppression. And it's very important that we not do that. Out of our own self-respect, We make a stand and we say, I'm going to eat as healthfully as I can. I'm going to feed my kids as healthfully as I can. I'm not going to subject myself or my family as much as possible to the foods that devitalize me, that reduce me to a pawn in this economic system, that take into my body the pain and the suffering when I could be taking into myself something much more wholesome and life-giving.
John, I think a lot of people have an external locus of control in that they think what's healthy for them is what health officials tell them what's healthy for them. And in Canada, we've had a rather welcome development in regards to Atkins, in that Health Canada says there's no scientific evidence to support low-carb diets. So in 2005, no product on Canadian shelves can be labeled low-carb.
That's terrific. It's
amazing. So for me, that says progress, that says the system works, that our health officials really are concerned about the public's health.
Yes.
Now, from doing this show and everything I've read and learned and also from your books, I think I can say unequivocally that dairy is among the worst things we can be ingesting. So my question to you is that true? And if it is, why aren't our health officials acknowledging that, just like they're doing with the low-carb stuff?
The science on dairy is a little more complex than it is on low carb. There's really absolutely no scientific validity to the Atkins phenomena. It is a way to lose weight, and if you eat low-calorie diets, you're going to lose weight. You could also lose weight by undergoing chemotherapy or getting malaria or becoming a heroin addict. There's all kinds of unhealthy ways to lose weight, and I'd put the Atkins diet in that same list, frankly. It will lose weight, but you mortgage your health in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the dairy industry has had an enormous impact on the political and economic realities of food production in North America and in Western Europe as well. This is a very difficult situation to deal with because they have had so much say in policy that they have shaped the policies. And out of that, what people have been told. In the United States, for example, the Department of Agriculture has a dual mandate. It has two basic requirements to fulfill. One is to promote the sale of U.S. agricultural products, and the other is to oversee the nutritional education in the country. Now, when you get someone in the USDA who is from the dairy industry and from the cattle industry, as has been the case unremittingly in the last 40 years, they then blend those two mandates and seek to promote the sale of dairy products and meat products by providing nutritional education that does that, has that effect.
Right, yeah.
So we have the four basic food groups. We have dairy as a whole food group. We have meat as a whole food group. When we know that people who don't eat from those groups are healthier by virtually every measure we have of assessing health outcomes. They have less heart disease, they have less diabetes, they have less of most forms of cancer. They live longer, healthier lives. And yet we're telling our kids repeatedly, we're telling our adults repeatedly, and also the industry is doing this not only through government, but also through advertising, that this is what you need to eat. And so people fall in line because we are greatly affected by that propaganda, industrial propaganda. And it takes an act of courage to educate yourself and to say, well, wait a minute, for example, with milk, why are we eating from the udder of a cow? I mean, if you think about it, can you think of a single other animal on earth that drinks the milk of another animal or drinks any milk after its own infancy?
No, indeed.
Then you look at the data. Now, I mean, dairy products are high in calcium. That's true. And they provide a lot of protein. That is true. But most people actually in the industrialized world eat too much protein for their own good, particularly too much animal protein. There are other ways to get calcium that don't, as dairy does, include the cholesterol, the saturated fat, and the products of the factory farms, because most of the dairy products, the vast majority of the dairy products eaten in North America today and in Western Europe, are the products of what I call factory farms. These aren't family farms with, you know, a cow out on the back meadow. They're extraordinarily cruel, where the animals are kept in feedlots and all of their basic needs are violated. All of their instincts are frustrated. There's no effort to create a context in which they are thriving as animals. The whole effort is just to get maximum revenue out of them. Mm-hmm. And that is done in a way that costs those animals dearly. This is something that I hold as a very important part of this. When you treat an animal with that degree of cruelty, it's really quite extreme, then I believe that something of that cruelty, something of that animal's suffering, goes into its milk and is conveyed to the person who consumes that milk. Now, every human mother who nurses, breastfeeds her young, learns quickly that her own moods get reflected in the children. Mm. If she's in a bad mood when she's nursing her baby, that baby will often get very fussy. And on the other hand, if she's feeling peaceful and joyful and glad, very often when she nurses the baby will start to emulate those emotions. And I think something of who we are is conveyed in that way. And I think it happens also from a cow. When the cow is treated like a four-legged milk pump and is confined in conditions that are grotesque and abominable by any level of humane standards, and then we drink the milk or eat the cheese or the ice cream made from the milk from that cow, what are we doing to ourselves? So this ties into a question you asked me earlier about the spiritual realities and implications of our food choices. I think if we want to be people who handle our emotions with some degree of equanimity, if our lives to be reflective of the prayer, let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me, if we want to have some emotional and inner peace in our lives, what are we doing to ourselves if we're eating products that come from animals whose lives have been tortured with fear and pain?
One of the things that Rob and I often talk about after the show or just as we're trying to set up various different interviews is throughout our lives, I think that we encounter people that look at some of these conditions, start seeing some of these connections, and feel generally pretty overwhelmed once they start learning about these things. But there's always people that we meet, too, and this is something that Rob and I are continually frustrated by and at a loss about how to address, is when you meet people who just seem to not care very much, and that is education enough? And what happens when people find out and they just say, well, you know, that does not really concern me, or it's not really my issue? So that for the people who are closed, I guess it's a general question about what are the obstacles that people face or encounter once they've been exposed to the type of information that you're putting forward that prevents them from making any change in their lives.
Well, people don't want to change a lot of times, and they will resist information that would ask them to change. They don't want to go to the trouble of reconfiguring their lives and altering their food habits. In fact, I actually think I would generate less resistance, and I would encounter less resistance if, instead of running around telling people about these things and providing information that by its nature suggests that they might want to change their habits, if instead of that I was going around telling people they should have sex change operations. I mean, I really think sometimes I would encounter less emotional resistance, because people's attachments to the way they've eaten and their food preferences are very deep and contain very profound emotional material. And it takes courage to look at who we are and what we're doing and ask questions like, is how I'm eating actually serving me? Is it just a habit, or is it a true act of who I am? Does this actually serve me? And I often tell people that they may not be as concerned as I am, for example, about animal rights or animal welfare. They may be dealing with a lot of issues in their own lives and have their hands full. I understand that. And that they can only deal with so much. I understand that. But what I'm trying to say is, if you want to deal well with what you're dealing with, whatever that is, you need to be healthy. And if you're eating food that is bringing you down and deadening your life force and squashing your spirit and reinforcing your belief that your choices don't matter, that who you are doesn't make a difference, that your love is not valid, that your love isn't a central part of who you are. If you're eating food that in by its nature and by the whole habit of it is denying the power of who you are, then you're not going to be able to deal very well with what you are dealing with. Mm-hmm. And you're going to end up increasingly in a smaller space inside yourself, more contracted and more dead. And I don't think that serves anybody. So, you know, I think that it's very interesting how interconnected we all are with one another and with the greater world. And we sometimes forget that. For example, when an animal is treated really badly, as they are routinely in factory farms, the animals get sick. They can't thrive under those conditions. And so then the industry deals with those illnesses in the animals by feeding them antibiotics in every meal and using a whole bunch of other chemicals. Residues from those chemicals then end up contaminating the meats and the dairy products and the eggs that people eat and then affecting their health. So if you want to eat a purer product, if you want to eat a more wholesome product, and who wouldn't, then it doesn't serve you. It's not consistent with that need to eat from products of factory farms. I mean, at the very most selfish, self-interested level, we've got to get rid of factory farms. Mm-hmm. From a human perspective, we've got to get rid of factory farms. And I don't say that because I don't value the well-being of animals, because I very much do. But I'm saying that whichever side you come to this from, whether you come to it from compassion for animals and wanting to see them treated with respect, or whether you come from it just from a surely personally selfish point of view of wanting your own life to be a healthy one, you end up at the same place.
John, I think the more knowledge we accrue about how eating animals affects everything on the planet and ourselves and each other, the more difficult it is for many of us to deal with those around us who are still eating animals. And I'm wondering about you, how that affects you and how you make peace with that.
Well, I know that everyone is where they are and that people wake up at different speeds. And I know that each of us can be very enlightened and aware in some areas of our life and yet not so aware in other areas of our life. I'm sure that's true about me. And I'm sure that I'm not even aware of some of the places that I'm unaware. Mm-hmm. That's how unconsciousness works.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm with someone who doesn't seem to be aware of what they're doing with their food choices, I try to teach by my example rather than by lecturing. Mm-hmm. I try to love them and care for them and respect who they are, even if I may not like what they're doing, but I try not to let that fact of my dislike for what they're doing get in the way of my relationship with who they are. And so I try to, you know, a woman once told me that in every woman there is a queen. If you talk to the queen in her, the queen will talk back to you. Hmm. And I kind of think with people, if you can find the goodness in them, the spirit of goodness within them, and address that and respond to that and bring that out of them, I really feel like rather than judging people, and certainly rather than condemning them for not living up to my expectations, if I can be an environment in which the best of them can come forward, if I can hold them with enough respect and appreciation and support that the best of them can feel safe to come out, then I'm doing my job. Then that's how I want to be. I don't always do that. I fail plenty. Mm-hmm. But that's the reference that I have. That's the overview. That's what I try to do.
It's interesting looking at your work, too. And I wonder about your perception of the animal rights movement in North America right now. One of the things that you talk about or imply, I think, throughout your work is notions of voluntary simplicity and really questioning our consumption levels. And we've had people on Animal Voices before that will plug, if you're going to go vegetarian, you know, you can eat your soy burger. Nothing really needs to change. It can be, packaged in layers of plastic, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing really needs to change. And I'm wondering, in terms of your own thoughts on voluntary simplicity and the people that you try to reach, do you think that that message is getting through to the animal rights and welfare movements, that it's a larger issue than just consuming a different type of a burger?
Well, not as much as I would like it to. I think that the whole environmental movement has regressed some in the last number of years. Unfortunately, it's kind of faded from some people's minds, and I think that's a loss, because how we treat the life support systems of the planet says a great deal about who we are, and it says even more about who we're going to become and what's going to be our fate in the future. And if we care about our children, and if we care about all children to come, then we really do need to shift our way of living so that we're not using so many resources, so that we're not producing so much waste, and so particularly that we're not producing so much toxic waste, and so that we're restoring the life support systems of the biosphere rather than destroying them. Right now, we have an economic agenda that rewards those who most rapidly convert the natural world into revenue. And we do not have any systems built into our economic structures to reward those who work to restore and truly conserve the natural world. It's interesting, in the United States, we have right now in our political system an administration that calls itself conservative. But they're not conserving anything hardly worth conserving. I mean, they are undermining all of the environmental legislation of the last 30, 40 years, actually. Mm-hmm. And as they do that, they're speeding the destruction rapidly, actually, of what gives us life. Our whole economic well-being depends on a healthy biosphere. It depends on a stable climate. It depends on having clean water and clean air. And if we continue the way we're going, our children are going to have a very difficult time making a living and having any kind of quality of life on this earth. And so, you know, to bring up packaging and consumption issues, to me, because I can see the direction we're headed as a society in the ways that I've just been describing, anything that any of us can do to reduce our level of consumption and to increase the earth-friendly nature of our lives, we should do. And we should talk about it. And we should share the pleasure of that and the joy of that with other people. Because it's not just a fad, being environmentally conscious. It's not just a style. It's a survival imperative.
John, I know that you only have a few more minutes left, and there's so many more questions that we could ask you, but I usually like to turn the last few minutes over to the guests so they can talk about the things that maybe that we didn't get to address on the show that you feel your last few words on the show would like to be dedicated to. You could talk about the food revolution, the newest book that you have out, as well as any other issue that you'd like to have some airtime for.
Well, I think a true revolution is guided by feelings of love. And it's very easy in these times to be consumed with outrage and consumed with grief and consumed with depression. And I mean, there's a lot to be upset about that's taking place. And I sometimes think if you aren't upset, you're not paying any attention because of that. But at the same time that we're upset, the same time that we grieve for the loss of species, and that is increasing. We grieve for the loss of cultures that are going extinct. We grieve for so much that is being lost in our times, and the presence of so much violence and destructiveness and insanity. I think we also need to have our other foot deeply grounded in the fact that at every moment there are people being born with new hopes and new dreams, and that at every moment there are children playing and people singing and dancing and people discovering new ways of communicating and resolving conflicts and developing friendships and building bridges and of communication and connection across racial lines, across cultural barriers, breaking through the walls that would separate us from each other and our wisdom and our connections with what gives us life. And I think we really need to understand the joy and the beauty in life, what's refreshing in life, what's life-giving, in ourselves and in our world, in order that our work not merely be a reaction to the pain and the destructiveness, but also be an expression and a realization of the vision. The vision that each of us holds in our hearts for a world that we would like to see occur. And so that we start to become congruent in how we live with the world we would like to see. I think that the means to the end need to be consistent with the end, which is why I'm so committed to nonviolence. Because I think when you adopt a violent means, a violent action, quite often what happens is you have a short-term result, but the long-term implications are not what you would wish. And I think we need to be quite grounded in the peace that we would bring to the world, that we would bring to ourselves, that we would bring into our relationships, that we would like to see prevail in our on our planet. And the sense of respect for one another and the sense of caring and cooperation rather than exploitation and domination. I really appreciate people who are undertaking this journey, this work, in whatever ways that they are, and in whatever languages they may speak of it. Because I have my language, but there's others. And I think there are a lot of people today feeling within themselves a need, the rising up of an instinct for life, for health, for the well-being and safety of their families, and not in a way that's isolating, but in a way that helps to build a neighborhood, a community, a nation, and a world eventually of peace and love. This is not a pipe dream. This isn't just a hallucination. This is actually what we need to do today, as never before, if we are, as a society and as a people and as a species, going to continue to thrive. It's no longer a time for survival of the fittest. It's a time now to treat thy neighbor as thyself and to learn what that asks us, of us, to learn to be capable and responsible for that. That's how I see the times.
John, you are some good medicine. A great part about doing this show is being able to thank the people that we admire. So I just wanted to take a moment to thank you for your work and for your message and for being with us today.
Yeah, it's been
a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for us, too. Thanks so much, John. I know that you're a very busy person and have a lot on the go, so we really appreciate you taking the time out and speaking with us today.
Thank you for doing the show.
Thanks.
All the best.
Thanks. Take care.